Amen. We're in 1 Timothy 3. If you want to open your Bibles to that text, we're going to spend most of our time, and some of it in the next book, back in Titus. But that's where we're going to be spending the majority of our time. We're continuing our study on the eldership. And we talked last couple weeks about the role of the elders, the authority of the elders, and what their responsibility is. And last week we talked about some of the issues that come along during the process that really hinder the process and really ways to kind of prevent that from happening, and realizing that a lot of times Satan gets in our hearts and causes a lot of things to happen and question a lot of things. And so, you know, we dealt with that a little bit last week to try to head off some things. This week we're going to deal with the qualifications themselves. And as I said last week, when you look at all these qualifications, all the qualifications except being a novice, being the husband of one wife, excuse me, having faithful children, all of us should have those characteristics in our lives. These must be exemplified, as we're going to talk today, to a little bit greater degree. But there's something that we should all be striving for and working for in our lives. When we get over to the qualifications given in 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1, we see that this is what Paul had challenged the early church through Timothy to exhort them to choose men that fit these qualifications. As we said and have said all along, when you read from the New Testament, there's no really any formula given. There's qualifications given, but there's no formula given on the selection process. And they've evidently left that up to the individual congregations themselves. And we went over some different ways that other congregations last week had appointed elders and the process that we're using to appoint elders. So God kind of leaves that open for us, but he does say, and he does have the qualifications given here for us, and these are very critical for us as a congregation that we follow these. We start out reading in 1 Timothy chapter 3. I didn't pass out any sheets. Has anybody got 1 Timothy 3 chapter 1? I've got the simple English version. It's a little bit different than what some of you guys might read. We'll just compare some of the notes. But does anybody have, Joe, you got it? 1 Timothy chapter 3. Yeah, read verse 1. Okay, I want to stop right there. What's one of the things that an overseer or an elder, as my version says, and that's one of the things we talked about earlier, some of the names for those men we're selecting. What's one of the first things that must, that kind of stands out here in this verse?
They must desire.
Okay, there must be a desire for them to want that work that they're engaging in. How do we know if someone desires that work? Is it wrong to go out and, how do I say this? A lot of times there's a lot of political games involved in the process. How do we know somebody desires it without getting the political process here? That someone lobbies for it. I really want to be an elder real bad. Is it wrong to do that? What's that, Bob?
They have that passion.
Okay, they have a passion for doing that. Kathy suggests that we could go to the individuals and ask them privately. Okay, I think that's a real key, Joe. Joe suggests that you have to look at the individual's motives, why they desire that work. What's the reasoning for it? Whenever we interview school teachers, for example, or administrators, one of the first questions we ask them, why do you want this? Why do you desire to be a school teacher? And if they give a whole bunch of reasons other than, I really love kids, I really don't listen to them. Because that's one of the things that sticks out in my mind, to have to love kids to be a school teacher. Why would you want to desire to be a shepherd? What would be some good answers when you're looking for somebody to be a shepherd? What would some of the answers be that you should look for? Because if somebody desires it, they have to desire it. You shouldn't have to ask them, do you really want to be an elder? They really want to do that work. Why would they want to do that work? They love the people. And what else? They love God. Those two reasons, and those two reasons only, should be right at the top of your list of individuals who are wanting to serve in that position. They love God more than anything else, and they love God's people more than anything else, and they want to help them get to heaven. Anything else is just by the wayside. But those two reasons there alone are good and great reasons, and the only reasons why someone should desire to be an elder. They want to help God's people get home, and they love God. And so Timothy starts out here by saying, you know, that individual has that goal in mind of serving God's family, of serving his people. They love his people. Now, when you love somebody, whether it's God or whether it's his people, how will you treat them? And I think that's why we have to look at the motive. How will you handle situations? How will you treat people? Okay, with a lot of love, a lot of kindness, a lot of truth. A lot of those things, you don't want somebody in there that's going to bulldoze over, that's going to put you down to make you feel little, show their authority, show their power. You want somebody in there that loves you, that's going to help you through situations, that have helped you in the past through situations, that help you deal with things, someone that you can feel comfortable with and know when I go to them, that they love me enough that they're going to have my best interest in their heart. And they're going to say things that I need to hear in a loving way. And so, you know, when you have someone that has that desire in their heart, it says here that they've set their desire, their heart, on a good work. And it is a work. It's a lot of work, and it's a great work. It's a good work. So we want to look for somebody that has that desire, first of all, in their heart to serve God and to serve their people in a loving way. Okay, any thoughts before we move on to verse 2, or any questions on verse 1? Okay, read the next verse for us, Joe, if you would.
Now the overseer is to be above reproach, faithful to his wife, temperate, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not given to drunkenness, not violent but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money.
Okay, now it starts out, an elder or an overseer, what's the next verse it has, the word it has here? Must. The rest of these qualifications, all these qualifications, they are not an optional thing, church. There's not a single one of them that is optional. It says they must have, and it goes on to list these characteristics that they must, that we've got to look for in their lives. Are they going to be perfect in all of them? Absolutely not. But they must have a degree of these in their lives that people know that they do have them. So keep that in mind, that an elder must possess these things here. What's the first thing it said, Joe, that he must have? How's yours read?
Reproach.
Does any of you have another term there?
Blameless.
That's the King James Version most of them have. What does it mean, above reproach or blameless? Do you know anybody that is perfect, that hasn't sinned? What's he saying here then? That they got to be blameless.
Not to judge.
Not to judge. Well, I'm thinking a little bit differently. And what Nancy says is not be in trouble with the law. Of course, we don't want somebody that's in trouble with the law to lead us. What he's trying to get across here and what he's trying to say to us is that when you look at the Greek word here and you look at the definition and you're there, it says one that cannot be laid hold of. In other words, I can accuse HP of anything, but will it stand up in a court of law? Will it stand up here? Because anybody can be accused of anything, but will it stand up? For example, would you want, if HP doesn't come to church service and I'm struggling coming to church service, would HP be a good elder to come to me and say, you need to be more faithful in your attendance? What's the first thing I'm going to say to him? Yeah, how about you? You see, that's the principle of what they're saying here about being blameless. That if you have a problem that's going to stand out in your life, you're going to have trouble with the rest of the flock going and trying to shepherd them and helping them get closer to God. So you need to be above that reproach. You need to be above that, that your lifestyle, they can accuse you of that, but your lifestyle indicates, and attendance charts indicates, HP's here all the time. You see, that's what he's saying in all these areas. It's not that HP is going to be a perfect individual, but when you elder, when you shepherd people, and you talk to them about problems, the first thing, they are defensive about stuff. And they want to look at your life, how are you living? And if you're not living up to that expectation, then you're going to have a hard time shepherding them and helping them. And that's what the term blameless here means, not perfect, but it's above reproach. That when that stone is cast toward you, you're able to say, you know, I'm here all the time. Or whatever the case may be, you know, I see you have a drinking problem. If you have a drinking problem, how can you help somebody else with a drinking problem? That's the principle is here. You know, you can't help somebody if you're engaged in it yourself. You need to have that. So that's the term why he starts out here by saying you need to be blameless or above reproach. The simple English says, must be such a good man that no one can rightly criticize him. And that's the whole philosophy or whole thought by here. Okay, the next one that Joe read to us, he must be what? Husband of one wife or faithful to his wife. Now, we don't have a struggle here, but it is coming into church rapidly. What does this verse exclude? What group of people does this exclude from being a shepherd? Women. Please, I love you women. But for this characteristic, for this work, it says you must be the husband of one wife. Faithful. Women cannot be that, and yet it's a real plague in our brotherhood, and I don't understand that, how they come around this. I know what they're saying. They're saying that this term, it was because of the society that they lived in, these rules applied to that society. But in our society today, where women have equal rights, well, they got to realize something, that this is inspired, these words are inspired by God. And if he wanted it open up to everybody, he would have said that. But he chose to say the husband of one wife. So it has to be a male figure in that position. That's what God says here. And we need to keep that in mind. Now, what does he mean by the husband of one wife? What if you were married and your wife died? Are you still the husband of one wife or are you the husband of two wives? Huh? You're considered to be the husband of one wife? Or what if your wife passes away? Or something happens, and God forbid it, but you get a separation, you're divorced from your wife, and you would remarry. Would you be the husband of one wife or the husband of two wives? We got a split decision here. Does God give us the authority to... You know, when Moses said that he gave them the right to write a bill of divorcement, and then Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 talks about, you know, are not bound by the law. They're loose from the law, the women. If you're scripturally divorced, if you're divorced for the right reason, you're okay. You're the husband of one wife. So what was he saying here? What did this have reference to then? Most of us just have one wife today, but what were some of the things that was going on back here?
Polygamy
was a big thing, as Jerry said. In the Old Testament, how many prominent characters do you read about that had more than one wife or concubines? There were several that we read about, but that wasn't what God had planned for man, but they'd done it. And for the leader of the new church that Jesus had bought with his blood here, he said, those people who lead, who take the shepherd, who take the bishopry, those individuals, we want them to be the husband of one wife. It's so plain here that you cannot have more than one wife or a concubine or whatever society you live in, one woman for one man. That's what he's saying. And that's important. If your wife passes away and you get married again, you're still just a husband of one wife. If you're scripturally divorced and remarried, you're still just a husband of one wife. And sometimes I've known in congregations that that's been a big hangover. They feel that if someone has been divorced or someone's wife had died, they can't serve as an elder. Now, do they have to have a wife? What happens if you're in the eldership and your wife would pass away? What should happen? Okay, Jerry suggests that according to the passage, it would be wise to step down from that eldership position. Any other thoughts? I've seen it work in congregations both ways, really. And what I've come to conclude, and this is my personal conclusion on it, is it's up to the congregation how they feel comfortable with it. His wife has passed away. There's other characteristics or other qualities. For instance, being given to hospitality is a big thing. And sometimes it's kind of, I can't imagine me inviting a whole bunch of you people over and cooking for you guys. Or, you know, us just getting together. I like to open my house to people, but if you expect something when you come to eat, you're going to be disappointed if it's not rice checks. You know what I'm saying? So there's other characteristics that go along with this that your wife really plays a very important role in. I mean, she opens a lot of doors when you have people in your home and to ease relationships and to help in the ministering of that problem. So the wife is a big part of this. And for me personally, if something would happen to Nancy, I would step down because I don't think I could minister you folks correctly. I really don't. But in other congregations, they've left up to individuals. I know the congregations who the men's, their wife had passed on, and they stayed on as an elder, and the congregation didn't struggle with that. They were okay with that. So I think as long as they're the husband of one wife, I kind of stick with that idea like Jerry, and I would step down and not have a problem with that. How do the rest of you feel? Any positive or negatives on that? I see your logic with that. I really do. How the rest of you feel?
Well, somebody behind me, I won't mention names, said that the congregations are afraid of finding another wife.
The congregations would do what?
Find him another wife.
Find him another wife. Okay. I hope the congregation chooses wisely, is all I'd have to say. And to be honest about it, most congregations kind of tend to go that way. I know of only one congregation that really raised a real problem over this when his wife died, and they really had a terrible time, really struggled with this, and it really kind of got messy because the individual, he didn't see the need for it because he still was the husband of one wife, and she had passed away, he was loosened from her, but He wanted to stay on to help the church, and I think his motives was right. You know, he loved the church, and he wanted to make sure that it went the right direction. He was concerned about that, but the congregation felt, like Jerry, that qualification was there, and they needed to stick to it. And it really caused the problems. It would have been much better if that guy would have stepped down and still helped behind the scenes instead of caused the problems and divisions that happened in that congregation. So a lot of it is a personal thing, and if it doesn't get personal, then the congregation gets involved and it gets messy. It really does. I tend to agree with Jerry that it's better to step down, really. And
I just would look at it from God's perspective, and I can't speak for you, but I imagine at some point there is a time where you have to share something with Nancy that's on
A lot of times, especially when you're ministering or when you're helping other ladies, I don't think like a woman. You guys are different in a lovely way. I'm saying that in a lovely way, a nice way. But I do. There are things that I bounce off of Nancy without giving names or anything, you know, to help me to understand the situation a whole lot better, because they have a different outlook on things. And it's amazing, my thought pattern was different than Nancy's in that respect, and it's helped me tremendously when I deal with that situation. So it is important to have that helpmate that I can bounce those ideas off of in that area. And that's why I would have a struggle in staying on. That's one reason why I think it'd be better for the congregation and better for me personally, because I wouldn't have that helpmate to do that. But I just didn't want to get hung up on this, that if that occurs, what to anticipate. Jay, you had a thought before we moved on? Sure, go ahead.
Not much the physical thought of it.
Okay.
But I think what God is getting at here is if a man is faithful to one wife, he's demonstrating his lifetime commitment to that wife that would demonstrate that commitment also to the church. Mm. Because if you go on down through the rest of the qualifications, it talks about
faithful
children.
Mm-hmm.
Demonstrate that he can be in the church.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That Harold demonstrated a lifetime of commitment as he did to the church.
Yep. That's a valid point. That's a good point, really. So, did Harold do it on his own, or the other elder? Do you know if they asked him? So it was a personal thing, like Donna suggested. And that's a good point, you know, that one of the reasons for that very well could possibility that the congregation looked at an individual, his faithfulness to his wife. So that's a good point. But back here, they was really plagued with polygamy real bad. And so, you know, God wanted to make clear that you're faithful to that one person, to that mate, not several. Anything else before we move on to the next characteristic?
Rob.
Yes.
Going back to the first one, and again, I've heard it both ways. Just looking at the scripture in the Bible here, it says about husband of one wife, and some people will say if it's a scripture divorce based upon adultery and the person's remarried, that's acceptable. I've heard that teaching. However, when I go down and look at number four, one who rules his own house well, having his children in submission with all reverence, okay, if it is a blended family and there's a remarriage and everything's scriptural, that's not that individual's children. Likewise, I don't know of any situation to date where both parties would not be at some fault if there was a divorce. I don't think there's ever a case where it would be 100% with one person. And to me, God has established here the elders and the overseers, for lack of a better word, are the elite. He wants the best. Okay? The best. And that doesn't mean people can't serve as being Christians. But God has established the criteria here that he wants the best of the best to rule his church.
In a very loving way, I'm not sure I agree with you. I understand what you're saying. I don't like the term elite, because I don't like anybody look at me as elite. I'm just Rob, chosen as one of yours to serve you. And I think what he's saying here with these characteristics, and the reason he said he must have these and telling the church to look at them, is the fact that it provides that leadership that they're comfortable with. Like Jay was talking about there, of seeing someone who hasn't been married several times or doesn't engage with polygamy activity now, but faithful to his wife and his children, and he goes on down through the rest of these characteristics, and you see these in their lives, those are the ones who are more apt to care for the flock and love them enough to help them to get to heaven. And I think it would be wise, but I'm not going to say you're sinning if you've been divorced and Scripture remarried, and for the reason that we talked about being blameless. Because if I go to counsel, and this is one of the big things that people come when they have marriage problems, you know, if I've been divorced several times and scripturally divorced, it might present a problem when I talk to somebody about keeping your relationship, you know. And so I would use some wisdom in that area, and I think, you know, that God would want us, but I can't say 100% sure that that individual cannot serve as an elder if he's been that way.
No, I'm saying, I lean to the more conservative side there, yeah. But I don't have an issue. I think it boils down to an individual elder's decision.
And the congregation has to feel comfortable with that too, you know, those individuals in there. We're in a super conservative area here, which I really appreciate. But there are some areas that they are not as conservative as here. And the congregations, they wouldn't have trouble with somebody that has even been, I know, unscripturally and put in here as a shepherd. And I really struggle with some of those things. But I think what he was saying, you know, to us here is that you have to have those characteristics to be a leader, draw people closer to God, to keep them marching in the same step, to loving each other and loving God. And when you look at these characteristics, it all points to that. That desire and that motive, that correct motive that we talked about, has to be there. I love God more than anything else. I love His people. God won't give you any problems. However, the people do sometimes. You know, because we're all different personalities. We all have different things, different agendas and stuff. It's working with them, and that's what takes a lot of time. That's why these characteristics are so important. We understand those characteristics, that these individuals possess a degree of some of these in their lives so that I feel comfortable in them ministering and helping me get closer to home, closer to God. And that's what's important. Must have be the husband of one wife or faithful to his wife, as some versions have it. The next one, he must have self-control. Is that what your version says? Or does it say something different?
Temperate.
Okay, temperate. Anything else?
Sober-minded.
Sober-minded. Okay. What is he getting at when he talks about being sober-minded, being temperate, or having self-control when you look at that individual? What do you think of, or what would be the opposite of that? That might help us understand what he's saying here.
Out of control.
Out of control? Okay.
Quick to get angry.
Okay. That'd be along with what Susan was saying, quick to get angry. Why is it important for that individual not to have those characteristics, but to be just the opposite of being someone who is temperate, someone who is self-controlled? Yeah. Yeah. Do you ever know somebody that flies off the handle at the least little thing? You've worked for a couple. Did you work for them or with them?
I worked for one year. Okay,
that's my whole point. You did not enjoy going to them for advice or for anything reason, because of the fact they would fly off the handle very easy. You stayed there because you were paid. These folks won't stay here. They're not paid to be here. That's why this characteristic is so important for individuals, because when you talk to somebody, you've got to talk to them in a spirit of love, compassion, being helpful, not flying off the handle saying, well, you stupid idiot, you should have known better. You know, you can't get someone like that that gets angry quickly. You want somebody that ministers you and loves you. And even though I might be dead wrong in the situation, they're going to tell me in a very nice way how stupid I was and how dumb I was. And then they're going to build me back up again. if you're sober-minded, if you're in control, if you have the situation in hand, you can do that. But somebody who flies off the handle, somebody who's quick-tempered, and somebody who doesn't think rationally, that's the opposite of sober-minded. Have you ever been around somebody that's drunk, that's not sober, that doesn't think right, and says stupid things? You don't want that advice. You don't go to a drunk for advice. You wouldn't go to a shepherd if he's not sober-minded for advice either. So that's a very key and very important characteristic, that you go to somebody who has that ability to sit down with you in a loving spirit, knowing that even though I might be wrong, they're not going to fly off the handle, but they're going to help me to get back to where I need to be. So that's a very important characteristic of that individual, that he doesn't fly off the handle, that he does have that self-control in his life. Yes?
Do you think it's interesting that Peter wasn't after?
Yes, I do. I think that's the key to it. I think that's the whole key to it. Now, you wouldn't, if you'd have known Peter in his younger years when he first got off that boat and met Jesus and he'd done those dumb things, would you have said he's going to be a good elder someday? Don't look at folks in here who done that in their younger years and say they'd never make a good elder either, because people change. And that's the great thing about Christianity, is we all have that ability and the help from God to change ourselves, and that's what we should be striving for. And that's an excellent point, because a lot of people have just thrown Peter off the wagon and said, you know, I remember in his younger years when he just really was quick to draw and very angry. They had never put him Peter in there. But Peter changed his life so much, especially after he seen the risen Savior. That's when he changed more than anything else, that his life changed and he became more sober-minded. He became more patient with people and he helped more people. And so, you know, I think they looked at those characteristics more than anything else. And that tells me, you know, don't look at somebody how they were in the past. Look at them how they are now when we go through this process. And that's important for us to choose somebody who has that self-control that doesn't fly off the handle. What's the next thing he says that they must do here? Must be of good behavior. What does that mean to you? Must be of good behavior. What's the opposite? If you're not in good behavior, huh? Yeah. You wouldn't want a shepherd that you're reading the paper all the time in the police log, okay? Somebody who's picked up all the time, or somebody who behaves poorly. One of the struggles that I don't see it in this congregation, but I know of other congregations who have selected men to serve as their shepherds. And it has affected some in this congregation, but they've known of shepherds who, even while they were shepherds, used very, very abusive language, poor behavior. They'd be at a sporting game and they would cuss and yell at the officials, "You stupid, blah, blah, blah." You know, why would you want that kind of shepherd? That's just not what he's saying here, is it? You want somebody who can behave themselves. And that's not saying that I'm not going to get angry, I'm not going to get emotional when the Steelers don't score or something like that, but I'm going to use good judgment, and I'm not going to act as a fool. So, you know, what he's saying here, that we have to behave ourselves in the public's eye as well as in the church. And the public is more important, really, for this characteristic than the church. Because one of the characteristics we get in later is, you know, that there's no charges from the outside as well. And that's where I'm at 90% of the time. Out there with the people. The other 10%, you know, we're here at worship service. So you want somebody that behaves themselves in all situations. You know, it's easy to come here and be good, but how about when you're out there? That's what it's all about. So somebody that behaves himself well in all situations, that's important. Okay, what's the next characteristic he gives here that they must have a degree of? Okay, what does this mean to you? Must be hospitable. Like I said, Nancy is an important part of that hospitality, but how about the shepherd themselves? How do they initiate this hospitality? And why is this an important characteristic that he was saying that these individuals must have? Any thoughts?
Someone that walks and feels they can openly come to, their house or come to see them and talk to them.
Okay. And a lot of times, we don't go to people's homes near as much as what we used to when I was a little boy. There was somebody at our house almost every Sunday from church. And every time there was a gospel meeting, that preacher, I knew what we was going to have for Sunday lunch. I knew what we was going to have when that preacher was coming. And I didn't mind it. It was okay. But I'm just saying, we don't open our doors as much in today's society as we did years ago. And so we have to be, we still have to meet this characteristic. And there's other ways to be, to meet this hospitality. Today we're caught up into electronic, whether it's face mail or emails or phone calls or whatever. And it's going to continue growing out of the area. In all these areas that Jesus didn't have and Peter didn't have here, we still have to find this characteristic in our lives. We have to be hospitable. We have to have that hospitality to us. We have to have that openness, whether it's in my house, whether it's on the telephone, whether it's through email, however, or right here. You have to have that hospitality. You have to have that approachability to them, that you're going to feel welcomed. And even to go home, I would take you home with me and we'll talk about it privately. That is being hospitable. That is having, it's an open door. Where, whichever phase of communications you use, that open door has to be there. Whenever somebody feels, did you ever call those, have a telemarketer call you? How do you feel when a telemarketer calls you and or you call in and you get one of those recordings? Do you feel that's very hostile to you?
No.
Not at all, do you? Now, would you trust your soul with those individuals?
No,
you wouldn't. And that's what he's saying here. You have to have that approachability that you feel very comfortable knowing I'm talking to a real live person here. It's not somebody that's going through an automatic thing. I'm sorry, sir. Your soul's in danger. Go your way. You know, I don't have time for you today. You can't do that. You have to have that approachability that, okay, let's talk. I hear you. And whenever you guys call, you say, are you busy? That's the first thing that usually comes out of your mouth. Are you busy? And I always say, no. Because I'm not busy for what you've got to talk about. I'll stop. It doesn't make any difference. I can hit my nail with my hammer any other time I want to, and I need a break. So talk to me. That's important. What's on your heart? That's the spirit that you have to have. Whether they come to your home, whether they call you on the phone, whether they text you or whatever, you've got to take the time to deal with the situation. And if an individual doesn't have that time, they're not going to be hostile. They're not going to show that hospitality at all. So that's a kind of important thing to have, that they have that ability to approachability to people to do that. Okay, what's the next one? Okay, apt to teach, some of your versions say. This has really been a stumbling block in some of the congregations. What does this mean? Apt to teach. Does it mean you have to preach from the pulpit? Does it mean that you have to teach from a Bible class? Does it mean you have to teach at home? Okay. I like that answer right there, because that's really what it means, Donna. And a lot of times we put qualifications that in our mind that really is not here. Donna said, if you didn't hear it, that you have to have that ability and that desire to teach somebody at any given time about the gospel of Jesus Christ, whether it's at home, whether it's at work, whether it's through a songbook, whether it's in a class situation or whatever. There are people that do not feel comfortable in standing up here. And it's not a comfortable position to always be in up here. But boy, they are great at home. They know people inside and out and have some tremendous Bible studies with home. Are they apt to teach? Yes, they are. You don't always have to feel comfortable standing before a group of people to teach. You can teach one-on-one. You can teach a family. And sometimes I think we in the church have closed a lot of doors by saying that individual has to almost be a gospel preacher and stand up here as a characteristic. And that's not what he's saying here. It says your heart, wherever you're at, whether it's a Walmart or wherever, if somebody wants to talk to you about the gospel of Jesus Christ, you're willing to talk to them about it. And that's what he's saying here. You have that apt or that ability, that desire to teach them the gospel of Jesus Christ. Okay? Do you agree or disagree? I know in days gone by, not so much this congregation, but they have left a lot of good men out because they felt he's never taught a Bible class in his life or he's never preached a sermon in his life. And so he's not apt to teach. But that individual taught a lot of people one-on-one, and they have left that they left an individual out. Apt to teach is exactly what Donna said. You want to share the gospel wherever you're at. And people don't always feel comfortable up here. Sometimes it's a growing process too. You start out at home and then you work your way up here to where you feel more comfortable. But you don't draw conclusions that you have to be up here all the time to be apt to teach. You certainly have to know what's taught and be able to correct situations wherever it's at, whether it's publicly or privately. But you have to have that desire to teach individuals. Okay. First lights went off. John. Not when I was younger. Jerry, would you do that today? Most teachers, not all the teachers in here, I don't think would do that today. Let me ask you a question, John, because I'm lost up here. What does bipolar have to do with what we're talking about? I mean, I'm a little lost. Okay. Well, that's kind of what, you know, we were talking about with Peter. If we'd looked at him in his younger years, we probably wouldn't have said he's a good elder because he was really quick to say things and quick to do things that he didn't have the patience. But as he grew older, especially after we read about him after the cross, he made a great elder. So it's important to give people that growing space. Yeah. Nah, I think you're in the wrong game. But you're okay. No, I understand. It's important to look at the person where he's at now. And that's what we're going through these things at, you know, being apt to teach and having self-control and all these things. You know, we're looking at the individual, not how he was 10 years ago or 5 years ago, but where he's at right now with the church. And it goes along with the first thing that we started out that Joe read to us there. Look at their motives of why they want to serve God. Jesus said it best when he said in Matthew 7, 15 through 20, you shall know an individual by his fruit. Look at his fruit. How's his fruit been lately? If it's been great fruit, that guy's got a good heart. He's wanting to serve God. He's wanting to serve his people. So if you don't see any fruit, then question it. Okay, let's close here and we'll pick up here next week. Tim, would you close us out with a prayer, please, sir?
Dear Lord, we thank you for this day.